Okay, the meeting will come to order. Since Chief Dolan has to leave, we'll start right away with his presentation. I would ask that, because he has a short time and has to leave, that the questions be held to the end for him. Okay, our first speaker today is the new chief of Minneapolis, Tim Dolan. He's grew up on the north side of Minneapolis, and now he's become a chief. He was previously the head of the north side police precinct, and somehow he managed to get along with all of the community activists, the neighborhood groups, and his own cops all at once, which is a miracle up there. With that, Tim, do you want to just start?
Sure. This is on. Thanks, Joe. I don't have a lot of prepared notes. The general request is to talk a little bit about the criminal justice system and our role in it, and then maybe talk about some questions. And I'll start by saying that City of Minneapolis, for those of you that give you a brief overview of this of our department. We've got about 840 sworn right now. We will be adding 40 to 45 more sworn in 2007 here. That's above attrition. Usually attrition-wise, we're looking at 2 to 3 officers per month attrition. We usually hire, though, we hire in waves, and we're heading into a time frame here when a lot of officers were hired, a lot of officers that are on the para-retirement versus the old retirement for the police pension. And there's a group of officers that are getting close to that 25 years of service and age 50. So we're going to see retirement pick up, maybe not so much in 2007, but in following years. So I know the classes that I came on, I'm heading towards I'm just over 50 and close to 30 years on, and the para retention, the para pension is pretty good pension, so we won't be looking for incentives to induce retirement anymore. Having said that, the department, Minneapolis Police Department, we have about 78 to 79% of our sworn personnel that are working in uniform, and that's not including people like myself that are in administration. That's just people that are working the streets, as we say. It does include traffic enforcement, but then it's the precinct enforcement. We've got about the remaining group, about 17% that are in investigations, and the rest that are in different administrative positions. As we're adding officers here, I had a promotion last Friday. I am adding to investigations. So I will not likely maintain that 79% as we're adding people. I will be adding people to the streets, but our emphasis is going to be adding people in different feet positions in places like Lake Street, Broadway, Uptown, Downtown, so as well as increasing investigations. So we look at the criminal justice system and what we do. We generally are involved in the criminal justice system when we see some sort of a violation. We do a lot outside the criminal justice system, obviously. When you look at traffic control, you look at just walking a beat, just trying to prevent traffic or prevent crimes. But it starts out with the criminal justice system when we either see or we are told of a violation of sorts, and that's important. If there's something that's seen, the officer can take direct action on anything from a status offense, which involves somebody that's underage. A status offense would be if you had an 18-year-old that was drinking. Well, that's a status offense. They're not allowed to drink until they're 21. Smoking offenses, curfew, truancy, those are status offenses. And it's a status offense because of their age. And that's the lowest level offense that we start out with. We then have what we call a petty misdemeanor offense, which is really a non-crime. We define crime as anything that you can go to jail for, or be sent to jail for. So it's, when you look at petty misdemeanor offenses, those are offenses that for an officer to arrest somebody, they would have to be a criteria in which there was like chronic offense. They've arrested this person many, many times before. They're shown that they're not going to come to court or not going to respond to a citation. But with those petty misdemeanors, we will normally cite or tag for such a violation. That could be anything from traffic to these minor, very minor criminal offenses, which would be like loitering, trespassing, that type of thing. So, but those type of things are usually raised to the misdemeanor level. Misdemeanor level is a level where we will also usually tag or cite unless they meet that criteria, in which they're not likely to respond, they're from out of town, they don't have identification, we can't identify them with some other means, or basically they've shown that they're not going to respond to that citation. Next level is gross misdemeanors. Gross misdemeanors are more serious misdemeanors where they can go to jail for. Some of your driving offenses like DUI and so forth are gross misdemeanors. And we will deal with the city attorney of all those gross misdemeanors and below. So when we look at crimes that were... I should correct myself here. We deal with the county attorney on status offenses like curfew and truancy with juveniles. They handle the juvenile crimes. But with adults, for those crimes that are below, gross misdemeanor below, we're dealing with the city attorney. And then we have felonies. Felonies are those more serious crimes. People can go to prison for a year or more. We deal with felonies in a number of different ways. They can occur in our presence. We can see them, or they can be reported to us. We can arrest for them. We can summons for them. We can petition for them, which is filing a complaint. Many different ways. Often when we arrest somebody for a felony, say narcotics, and they're brought down to jail, oftentimes they'll be released pending a complaint. We'll need more time either to look at the investigation, test the evidence, the dope, as this is. So we will might release and then recharge through a complaint, or they might have a case where, say, we have we have a wiretap or something like that. And we may issue a whole bunch of complaints and summonses on a when we bust that wire out and we issue those complaints. So there's a number of different ways of charging those felonies. You can be arrested, you can be released and recharged, or you can never, charge or follow up. So when we're working with felonies, we're working with the county attorney's office, and I see Peter Cahill's here to talk about some of that. So I won't get in too much depth on that. There's different courts that we deal with in the criminal justice system. If it's a crime against person, we're taking it over and we're dealing with different county attorneys, and he'll explain that. If it's a narcotics case, they may go to drug court or they may not. And I'll let him talk about that. If it's a juvenile, it's going to juvenile court. So there's a number of different courts that we'll deal with in a criminal justice system, depending on the type of offense that we're dealing with. When I look at investigations, now most of these things that I've been talking about, I haven't talked about a lengthy investigation. So if we get, for instance, a robbery or an aggravated assault or a homicide, we don't have somebody in custody We worked that case, and we will bring that through the county attorney's office and work with them on the charging of that case. And we'll generally be working with a attorney on that case. And what they'll do is, as we're working with an attorney, they'll be working with the officers and advising them what they need for criminal charging on that case. So if it's, say, for instance, a serious homicide, we'll present a case, and we'll get that case back, and they'll have what we call a wish list. I don't know if that's a formal name for it, but then they'll want an interview with X, Y, and Z. They'll maybe want an evidence tested this way or that way, and we'll put that together. So by the time we end up getting somebody charged, it's a pretty good package. And people talk about it, but their prosecution rate and their success in their prosecution rate is pretty high, very high. Another option in the criminal justice system is the federal system. And we will use the federal system on some cases. The feds like cases like if there's a narcotics case in which weapons were used. We have a felony level narcotics case, and it's the third felony case for an individual. That's when you hear the phrase three strikes and they're out. Well, they generally take those three narcotics, the offender for three felony narcotics offenses, and they put them away for an extremely long time. Same with weapons cases. They also like gang-related offenses in which there are narcotics, guns, and gangs. Or if there's a gang enterprise that they can charge. And we will work with the county attorney, we will work with the federal attorneys on deciding if cases should go state or federally. So, other than that, I think I'm more interested in answering your questions or anything you might have as far as what we're doing in relation to the criminal justice system.
To start off with, I've got a couple questions. You mentioned the third offense the feds are interested in. Does it have to be the third federal offense, or could it be two state convictions and the third one be the federal case?
Well, they're looking for just felony convictions, and they're looking for felony convictions at a certain level. So, not just, they'll be looking for first or second degree narcotics offenses, not felony narcotics offenses that are lower than that.
But I was just wondering, do they have to be in the federal system?
No.
The first two?
No, state.
Okay.
You're looking for state.
The second one, would you explain the difference between how a police officer decides to use a tab or a ticket, citation, complaint, how that distinction, and how that affects case?
Well, for the lower level on whether they're going to decide to cite or not, it's governed by statute 609. We refer to it as in 609 something that Pete could tell you offhand. But it says specifically when we have to cite versus when we may book. And it gets into the whether they have are likely to appear to court, whether we can identify them. I mean, if we're supposed to go through not just a driver's license, but if we can identify them by computer or other means. So it's outlined in that piece, and they will based on those lower level offenses, either tag or book, depending on whether they meet those criteria. For traffic offenses and so forth, it's pretty much a given that they will tag, unless we run across that person. They don't have a driver's license. Maybe they'll have a warrant. They have not appeared for this offense in the past. That's what the warrant will show. So it's a mixed bag. There's a lot of information that comes on the computer, either through the warrants or otherwise. They'll tell you if this person is going to be likely to appear. So they'll generally get a tag unless there's those circumstances which say this person's not likely to respond.
I'd like to get the question, since you have to leave, Representative Cornish.
Chief, I'm working on a bill, and I don't know how far it'll get in this committee, but it would outlaw administrative penalties. One thing that really hacks me, and I know the reason that some cities like to use them, but the problem I have with them is it cuts a lot of money out from coming to the state, and I know the converse or the reverse argument is that we cut LG and yada yada, and so they have to have a way to make money, and there's too much money that comes to us in surcharges and this and that and the other thing. But It seems to me almost like it reduces your options. I mean, it's such a temptation to pay it because it doesn't go on your record. It's usually a less of a fine that it circumvents the due process. That weighs more in their mind when whether they're guilty or not of the offense. And then I feel for my poor criminals and the defense attorneys. You don't get to prosecute and they don't get to defend. And it's so funny the trial lawyers haven't come out against this because it takes a lot of money out of their pocket. But at any rate, I was just kind of wondering what you thought of it. It's there for a purpose. And I realize the surcharges are a lot and how your officers handle it and what they, what you think of it.
Chief Thorne. Well, we don't have too many administrative fines that we're dealing with out there. I mean, I think you already have it. You have a state law that says if there is a state law regarding that type of offense, that they can't create an administrative penalty for that. So, if it's like for speeding or even stop on red, stopping on a red light or a semaphore, those type of things. So it has to be something that specifically an ordinance for the city, whatever the city is and it's involved. And it's not something that generally then is not governed by state statute. So I don't know enough about it to comment about, whether that's something that fiscally is needed for a city or if it's fiscally that's harmful to the state. I don't know enough about administrative fines and know, what extent those are. I know in other places, other states, administrative fines are used to a much greater extent. I would also say that we have an issue in the courts here in Hennepin County, in which there is an overload of not only traffic violations but those misdemeanor violations and other state violations where we're not keeping up in the courts here. So I don't think they're looking for more business in the courts. Maybe there's a way to handle it better, but it's
Representative Cornish follow.
It's something we could probably follow up on in the future meetings. But the problem is that there's some cities that are ignoring state statute, according to the Attorney General in a letter that he sent out, and nobody's gone too far as to take action yet, but they're actually being creative in making ordinances that duplicate the state statute so that they can go the administrative route and keep more of the fine money. And some of the cities, I think one of them, the metro area, if it was Maple Grove recently or something that came out, there was more and more of it going, and all those people that the traffic fine money right now is split up to a whole mess of different people. And that short circuits that funding mechanism. And I realize the purpose for it, but it is something interesting to take up a half an hour or so.
Well, Representative Cornish, you got to watch those Republican cities out there.
Yeah.
Was there any other? I think one of the two representatives there has the highest Republican index in the state. So, were there any other questions for Chief Dolan? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
That's too easy.
That's too easy, yeah. You can't get away that easy on the north side ever.
No.
Since we're a few minutes ahead, you can just sign out. And we didn't get a chance last time because session ran over so long. I wanted to have everybody introduce themselves, where you're from, name where you're from, and what interest you have on the committee. So I guess why don't we do Jeremy and then Paul and then just start at Sheldon and go around.
I'm Representative Jeremy Kalin, Vice Chair, represent District 17B, finishing, I used to know the math on this, but starting our 12th day right, Scott? Something like that. In the legislature, first termer. Again, Chisago County, North Branch, Lindstrom, Tearless Falls, Wyoming, and also have the challenge, and I believe Representative Westrum, that I'm following in your footsteps by getting my JD at William Mitchell while continuing to be a legislator. So it'll be a good challenge, and look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, on the committee.
Thank you. Paul. I'm Paul Coles. I represent District 34A, which is Central and Western Carver County and a portion of Northern Scott County. I was on the Civil Law Committee my first term, 2003 and 4. Took a session off and I'm back now. I'm pleased that the committee has a public safety focus as well. Looking forward to working with everybody during the session.
Sheldon, do you want to just go around?
I'm Sheldon Johnson. I represent Mounds Park, Battle Creek, Dayton's Bluff neighborhoods of St. Paul, and I've been in probation work for 30 plus years now. I'm particularly interested in community corrections, I guess, as an issue.
Representative Scott Kranz, first term. I represent the city of Blaine, primarily 51A. I'm a public high school teacher, and the area that interests me in this committee is not only also the civil justice part or the public safety part, but also victims of crimes.
Peter Saylor, District 2B, which is the western half of Hubbard County, almost all of Beltrami, most of Clearwater County, and a little bit of Polk and Pennington. And I'm interested in public safety issues primarily as they relate to counties and the sheriff's office and anything with the rural issues.
I'm Dave Olin. I represent District 1A, which is the northwest corner of the state. Britta is actually part of my county because in my former life I was county attorney in Pennington County for 32 years. I retired at the end of last year and got elected to the legislature, and that's pretty much why I'm here. I get the very northwest corner, Roseau and Kitson, half of the east part of Marshall County. The largest number of votes in Pennington County, although it's split three ways. I think that describes where I'm from.
I'm Trevor Bigham. I'm from 57A. So I have some of Cottage Grove, most of South St. Paul, St. Paul Park, Newport, Great Cloud Island Township. This is my first term in my full-time job is as a paralegal on the property crimes team in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. So my immediate supervisor is going to come and talk, so make me look good. And I public safety is because of my job, but I have interest in reentry and recidivism and just in general public safety and civil law stuff. So I'm pleased to be on here.
Steve Simon, second term member representing Hopkins and half of St. Louis Park, and I served my first term on the what was then the Civil Law and Elections Committee, so I look forward to continuing that work and the public safety component as well. Thanks.
Deborah Hillstrom, I represent all of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park. I've been on the Public Safety Committee for the entire 6 years I've been in the legislature, and I look forward to looking into civil law issues as well.
Hi, Representative Leon Lilly from North St. Paul Maplewood. This is a new committee for me. I'm in just starting my second term. And very excited to be here. As with most Minnesotans, or hopefully all of Minnesotans, we're concerned about public safety. So,
I'm Michael Paymar. I represent the 64B, which is some of the western neighborhoods of St. Paul along the Mississippi River. This is my sixth term in the legislature. In my private life, I'm a research specialist for the Battered Women's Justice Project in Minneapolis.
Tori Westrum, represent District 11A, which is western Minnesota. Counties of Douglas, Grant, and Stevens. Cities in those counties are Alexandria, Elba Lake, which is my hometown, and Morris, just for a reference. I guess I have an interest in both the civil and criminal side of our laws, and it's fascinating and interesting because what we do here is what affects so many people's lives privately and when they do wrongs to others, whether it's civil or criminal.
Well, Chris, Sela Forest, District 49A, Central Anoka County. I'm a holdover from the old Civil Law Committee, and if I'm not mistaken, I might be the only one left over from the 03-04 session. So, sentenced here first term, still here third term.
I'm Tony Cornish from Good Thunder, south of Mankato, from Blue Earth County, Faribault County, and Waseca County. I come from a background of 27 years of law enforcement as a policeman and deputy sheriff and a game warden, and when it comes to my interests, I'm probably pretty far to the right. I'm more of a lock-em-up life sentence person than I am a rehabilitation, but I have an open mind, willing to listen to anybody.
Representative Cornish, do you think we could rehabilitate you?
I'm Mary Lou Kohlberg. I am from Lakeville. I represent 12 of the 14 precincts in that city. This is my fifth term. Of my four previous terms, I was on civil law, three of them 2 years as chair. And you, Mr. Chair, you mentioned North Minneapolis. I did have the opportunity to do a ride along with the officers in North Minneapolis, and I would recommend that opportunity to any of the committee members that haven't. It was pretty obvious pretty quickly that we weren't in Lakeville anymore.
Representative Folger, I remember you talking to me about how different it was and how I don't know if you used this word scary, but something kind of like that. And then I found out where you were, and it was just the safe part north of the tracks.
Well, and Mr. Chair, when I did the ride along to Lakeville when I was the city council member, the most exciting thing that happened is we ended up in a ditch in Farmington at 4 in the morning. But when I was in Minneapolis, certainly I got to ride in the back seat with a number of maybe your more illustrious residents in that area, so I found it very interesting.
Actually, one night I was riding with the police up in that area where you were, and the worst call for the whole night was that there was somebody walking down the street, middle of the street, 3 o'clock in the morning with a lawnmower, and they thought it might be stolen. So, however, I think you forgot to mention a special interest of yours.
Oh, I do. I have worked on data practices issues, and I do think that they are important, and I spend a lot of time. And hopefully there will be somebody else in this committee that will share that interest, because it seems like virtually everybody that's gotten involved in the issue over the last 8 years is gone. So.
Then we'll start with the nonpartisan staff, Matt.
My name is Matt Gehring. I'm an analyst from the House Research Department, and for purposes of this committee, I'm responsible for civil law issues, which would include data practices and family law and pretty much everything that is not crime. So if you have any questions about any of those, let me know, and I can try to get you an answer.
Jeff Beeble, House Research. I cover public safety, corrections, and specifically the Department of Public Safety, and then sex offenses and anything related to that registration and community notifications. And I share the subject with my colleague, Becky, so between the two of us, we can answer all of your questions.
I'm Becky Perius. I'm an analyst with House Research as well. This is my third year covering public safety issues, and as Jeff mentioned, I share the criminal area with him, and I cover primarily sentencing, domestic abuse, crime victims, courts. And I look forward to working with you.
Jim Cleary was in here our first meeting. Usually he's around. He does crime statistics. Like, he was out in the hall when I came in, so I thought he would be here. But I don't see him right now. Okay.
I'm Vicki Benson. I'm the committee legislative assistant for this committee. I have been with the legislature for over 20 years. With the House, this is my 10th year. So I've been around for a while. Any questions whatsoever that you have regarding this committee or anything, please feel free to call me, email me, whatever. I am at your beck and call.
I'm Patrick Baldwin. I'm the committee administrator.
think I was assigned to this committee because of my experience as an attorney, a limited experience. I've done everything from juvenile law to, and in civil law, I've done family law and probate and bankruptcy. So I have an interest in all these issues, and I hope we have a good session working with all of you.
Asia Bonsi, DSL Research.
Dennis Verdon, Republican Research.
And Dennis, I think, has been with the Civil Law Committee longer than... I don't think anybody has been on it as long as you've been staffing it, have they?
Smith.
Oh, that's right. Well, Steve Smith, he's been on both ends of this committee since before everybody else was even in the legislature. So he's got about twice the terms of any of the rest of us. And I will be working with Dennis a lot because he's got a lot of institutional knowledge on the civil law side of this committee. Okay, then we is I think that's all the staff. Oh. What? Yeah. I can't remember her first name. Just found out.
My name is Kate Weeks. I'm with CSL Research, and I will be taking over for Asia, who's leaving at the end of the week. That's why I've been hovering in all the solicitations.
I knew the last name, and I couldn't remember the first. Okay, Pete and Jim. You're on. Actually, it was going to be Pete and then Jim, but why don't you, unless, is there, did one of you have somebody with you, or can you act civilly enough to each other to sit next to
me? We won't fight much.
I'll bet Jim's a better basketball player than you are.
It's not even a hype that makes that true.
That was a long time ago.
He was in the same IM law school basketball league as I was, and he was, I think, the lead scorer or something like that.
That was many years ago.
Pete Cahill is from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and Jim Hankus, I believe, is the lead public defender for Ramsey County. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Just one thing before we get into that. I forgot to send this around. This is for people that want to sign up for Representative Paymar committee tours. There's Red Wing, the so-called boot camp. That's the Challenge Incarceration. Then there's the Stillwater and Oak Park Heights morning arraignments in Ramsey County, and then the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I would recommend, if you haven't been to these, that you go there because they're all important parts of our system. And we'll turn that around. Okay, I think Pete, you were up first, I guess.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon, I think. My name is Pete Cahill, and I'm currently the managing attorney of the Special Litigation Division of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And I've been around here for a couple of years in my former role as the Chief Deputy County Attorney in Hennepin County. And what I thought I'd do is there's a handout that I believe has been distributed on the statutory duties of the county attorney. And that actually comes from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association website, and it has the address listed at the top. So if you have any questions, that website alone might give you some answers. What I'd like to do is follow up on Chief Dolan's comments and where we fit in the system. First of all, in criminal prosecution. The county attorneys in the state are responsible for the prosecution of felony-level crimes and also some designated gross misdemeanors, such as malicious punishment of a child. And those are designated by statute to be prosecuted by the county attorney. Misdemeanors for adults, most traffic offenses, misdemeanor assaults, misdemeanor thefts, similar offenses are prosecuted by city attorneys. In some of the cases, for example, I'm guessing that in his former life, Representative Olin probably was both city and county attorney and prosecuted everything. In the metro area, for example, in Hennepin County, the county attorney does strictly the county attorney work, the city attorney work, the misdemeanor prosecution is done either by employees of the city or most of the time on contract, where private law firms act as the city prosecutor on a contract basis. Some of them even do criminal defense on when they are not prosecuting. It gets a little confusing every now and then. I actually did this with a St. Louis Park city attorney, and I would go one day in as prosecutor for the city of St. Louis Park and then another day go to a different courthouse as a criminal defense lawyer. Sometimes I got a little confused over who I was representing. Nevertheless, as county attorney, in addition to the prosecution of adult felonies, and that's the full gamut, everything from violent crimes to drugs to property, if it's felony level, the county attorney is responsible for prosecution. We also prosecute juveniles, and in that sense, we are not convicting them of a crime, and that's, I'm not sure if Mr. Carruthers went over the differences between the two. But in juvenile court, what we're seeking most often is an adjudication of delinquency. Juveniles are found to be delinquent when they commit an act which for an adult would be a crime. And so unless it's a case where a person has been certified as an adult or received an adult conviction through the extended juvenile jurisdiction process, juveniles are not convicted of crime, they are adjudicated delinquent. And in that sense, the county attorney prosecutes just about everything that involves juvenile. We do status offenses as little as smoking by a minor. Everything, misdemeanor theft, right on up through the felonies. There is a small window of offenses that we do not prosecute, and those are the DWIs and the petty misdemeanor traffic offenses, where the city attorneys handle those as if the juvenile driver was an adult. And it's, we do prosecute kind of the midstream traffic offenses for juveniles, like careless driving and that type of thing. So it gets a little mixed up every now and then on what we prosecute for juveniles when it comes to the traffic area. But in non-traffic areas, the county attorney is the prosecutor for juveniles on all offenses. In how those cases are charged, Chief Dolan mentioned how they will do the arrest and the prosecute or the investigation. And it's generally at that stage where we start to become involved. Many times the police will complete their investigation and just hand the file over to us, and it is up to the county attorney's office to determine in a felony case whether or not the person is to be charged with a crime. There is no process for citations or tab charge for felonies. They have to be charged with a formal complaint. And very often the police will give us a complete investigation. Sometimes we'll turn it back with what he referred to as a wish list. We like to call it a to-do list, not a wish list. But in any case, that's when we start working with the police to complete an investigation and charge the case or, in some cases, decline prosecution. To give you a sense for Hennepin County, which is 1.1 million people roughly, 25% of the state's population, with about 30% to 40%, depending on the crime, of Part 1 crime in the state, we get about 9,000 felony referrals a year, 9 or 10,000 felony referrals, out of which we charge 6 to 7,000. You'll notice that that means we charge only about, I shouldn't say only, 60 to 70% of the cases that come in. Cases that are not charged generally might be because we don't believe we have enough evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Police can and should act on suspicion and probable cause, but we have to convict someone by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the difference in standards may result in some cases not being charged. Other reasons for not charging cases are that, for example, we believe maybe a search was unconstitutional or that a confession was obtained improperly. A variety of different legal issues that might impact our ability to prosecute successfully. Sometimes, especially in white-collar cases, we'll start working with the police before they even make a formal referral, and we will point them in the direction of what kind of investigation to do or take before they even make it a formal referral to our office for prosecution. And so we do work hand-in-hand with the police quite a bit, although we do not have jurisdiction over them. This is probably the most common misperception that I've found in the general public, is people would often call, and I talk to many of these people, who'd say, I talked to the police, and they're not willing to investigate my case, so I want you to call them and tell them to prosecute or to investigate the case. And then I have to explain that I really don't have authority to tell Tim Dolan to do anything. And it's not just because he wears a gun and I don't. Structurally, I don't have authority over the police department. We have the power of persuasion and cooperation, we hope, but we do not have that authority. Other states are different. In New Jersey, the district attorney actually has authority over the police and can determine their priorities and what they investigate. But my job is simply to persuade and hope that we can come to a common consensus on what should be investigated. Ultimately, people are sent back to the chief and the mayor and their city councils, who have ultimate authority over the police and what they investigate and what they do not. That, I think, pretty much summarizes the criminal prosecution. I just note that for the civil side, the county attorney's office actually has civil jurisdiction in a number of areas. In fact, 55% of our budget and personnel are devoted to criminal prosecution, but 45% are involved in civil matters. Everything from civil defense of the county, for example, if you slip and fall in the government center bricks, which has happened too many times, it's our office that will defend the county against any lawsuits. Other counties do not do it through an in-house division as we have, but rely on the Minnesota County Insurance Trust. Did I get that right? MCIT, that's how I know it. And they provide defense to counties on litigation. But every county attorney provides advice to their county boards, to their county departments, and treat them as clients. And for example, in the child protection area, which often gets a lot of different press, the Human Services Division or the Child Protection Division is a client, and therefore the department makes a lot of the decisions. Contrast that to criminal prosecution, where the prosecution division and the prosecutors make the charging decisions. They are pretty much in control. In the civil area, especially in human services, the department makes a lot of the decisions and we act as their attorney. It's also true in the mental health. We are responsible for mental health commitments, which includes the sexually dangerous persons, which obviously has become a big issue in the last few years after the arrest of Alfonso Rodriguez and the Drew Shadeen homicide. We also provide child protection services in the sense that we will file petitions to find that children are in need of protection and services. And I think that covered, collecting child support is obviously a major function of our office and all county attorney offices. With that, unless there are any questions, or I don't know if you wanted Mr. Hankus to...
Well, let's take corrections now. We've got Steve.
Representative Simon.
Sorry.
Thank you. I have a question for you about an issue that I've been approached about, and I don't know whether your office has taken a position on now or has historically, and it's the issue of sealing records of those, sealing arrest records where there was no conviction or plea, where someone was arrested, but for whatever reason, maybe some of the reasons that you mentioned, and maybe for other reasons, nothing more came of it. What's your, and I should specify, the folks who came to see me about it were talking about misdemeanor only, not felony. So if someone's arrested for a misdemeanor with certain exclusions, but nothing came of it past an arrest, there was no conviction or plea, that record would be sealed. Any thoughts on that, good, bad, or otherwise?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, last year, I testified actually against the expungement bill that was before the House, and I was testifying on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. The problem with it was that it seemed to be way too broad, and a lot of the functions that were thrown on to various government agencies to affirmatively expunge and notify people were pretty onerous. Some of the new drafts I've seen, I think, are a great improvement. They talk about expunging in the sense that it is sealed, but government agencies can still have access to it. I think that's very important because sometimes we might decline to prosecute a sex case, for example, because we don't think we have enough evidence. But then if a similar case that's stronger by the same perpetrator, we may go back and look at the first case and see if we can leverage the evidence from both cases together and charge both. So it's important that we keep access by the government agencies, the prosecutors and the police, to cases that have not been charged. But for cases that result in an arrest and no prosecution, for low-level offenses, non-person crimes, I think there is some merit into looking into some automatic expungement. I would hope that we can come up with a system that's efficient. That doesn't mean that I have to hire three more people just to deal with expungement.
Well, I have a follow-up then to that, because you've been a couple times to Northside communities. How do you think they would feel if you said that there's somebody that's arrested 300 times for loitering with intent to sell on 26th and Morgan North? Do you think the people there might want to know that so that they could watch for that person when they're out doing their community block work and things like that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think you're probably right. Those communities do want to know somebody with that extensive a record, and so I think somebody who's a chronic offender who is constantly out there, it would surprise me if that person wouldn't pick up some kind of conviction along the way. The city attorneys, while they are overwhelmed to a certain degree, do focus on chronic offenders and try and get the convictions. And the idea of expunging convictions, I think, is something that we should avoid, because people should be held accountable for their actions, but for cases that never resulted in a conviction, I think we can look at what population would be appropriate. And in that case, maybe that's not an appropriate person, despite the fact that they may not have convictions out of all those, that we expunge all of those different arrests because it does show a pattern of sorts. I'm not sure where to draw the line at this point.
Well,
but
Mr. Cahill, I'll give you an exact example. Fowler Neighborhood, who I think you are aware of, there was one house. I'll give you the block, 3700. I won't mention the street or the exact address. There was, when I was down at the police precinct one night, we looked at the five people living there, and there was a total of, I think there was over 600 and some arrests for the five people living there. Do you think that there might be some wanting for either the neighbors or a landlord that was renting there to want to know about that?
Mr. Chair, I think it's pretty clear that the neighbors and the landlord would like to know that. And something that extreme, obviously, that's not something. I'm not here pushing expungement. I'm just saying I think we're willing to look at certain people who may have. Let me give you a different example on the other side, which is somebody who 10 years ago had an expungement or had an arrest for misdemeanor theft, maybe a shoplift. We see, at least when I was city attorney, we saw a lot of stress-related shoplifting. Invariably, I'd talk to somebody who was representing themselves, and they break down crying, and you find out that they just had a death in their family, and they did something totally out of character. That type of person, where it was ultimately dismissed, and it would never result in a conviction, we should probably think about some type of expungement process for them. But the person who's a chronic offender who's out getting a lot of arrests, that's not the one I want to be out there advocating for expungement. Don't get me wrong.
You wouldn't be very popular on the Northside community meetings you come to, but second of all, I thought we had an expungement process on a case-by-case basis at the present time, or is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, that actually is correct. We have a petition process, and sometimes, though, when it's a matter of course, when the person is entitled to expungement because it's been dismissed, it causes a lot of administrative nightmare to prepare the petition, set it for a hearing, get responses from all the parties, in which invariably it's, well, this is a dismissal, and so the person's entitled to it under law, therefore I'm fine. I'm actually talking more about the process as opposed to sealing up everybody's records. I think automatic expungement is more for areas where it's been dismissed, and, you know, for somebody who's a low-level offender, and we shouldn't consider even for proper or for personal offenses. So I think it's more that we waste a lot of time on what will clearly end up being an expungement. And if there's any way we can fine-tune this to make that happen without clogging up the courts with expungement petitions that are going to be granted anyway, I think that's what we should be looking at, is to make that more efficient. We have one lawyer who's at calendars for expungement weekly. I think there were 600 petitions for expungement that we received and had to respond to last year. It's just growing because of the.
Okay, we better move. I didn't know that was going to be brought up today, this particular issue. Representative Westrum, you had a.
Mr. Chair, just a question. Getting back to the juvenile issue, do you know if any other states have 14 is usually is the standard of when a juvenile can be at least brought to be tried as an adult. Any other states higher in age or lower in age? And the reason I ask, myself and Representative Noinas and hopefully some others on this committee will, when we get the bill drafted, we'll look at it, but we've got a situation where a juvenile who murdered a child at the daycare center 3 weeks from being 14, not tried as an adult, and it seems to be that in some extreme cases, maybe we should relook at when a juvenile really can be tried as an adult. But are you familiar with other states or any other practices in that regard?
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, we have that exact age, 14, as the cutoff for adult prosecution in Minnesota. You cannot file any type of delinquency petition for any child who is under the age of 10, and so you can't even bring them into juvenile court. I do know that other states have no limit. You can bring any age juvenile, probably even as young as 2, I suppose, into juvenile court. That is not the law in Minnesota. We are more restrictive. I'm not sure if any states have a higher age limit, to be honest with you. I haven't looked at the issue. I know Jim Backstrom, the Dakota County Attorney, is kind of the juvenile justice expert within the County Attorneys Association. In fact, has served on the National District Attorneys Association Juvenile Justice Committee and has been its chair. And so he probably would be a better person to answer those questions. But the basic answer, 14 is the current, and no younger than 10 for any delinquency prosecution.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so in your tenure, is there anybody that's examined or studied or followed? Does it seem like juveniles might be doing more severe crimes at a younger age, or is it still just a random sort? It seems like watching the news and reading the papers, you hear about more of this, and I've even heard anecdotal evidence, or at least discussions that people say they've heard about, drug rings and kingpins and things like that, going to young good people to talk them into this because they know they can't get prosecuted as severely. Is there any merit to that, or is that, have you not noticed any difference in the trend in the last 10 or 20 years?
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, I have not really noticed much of a trend. It does go up and down. You see it bouncing up and down. For example, we had a spree of robberies committed by juveniles in Minneapolis and the uptown area and also on the north side. But I think it was more of a blip, and then once we concentrated on that and Chief Dolan was able to put some resources on it, we saw it decrease. Okay. You get the occasional homicide that's perpetrated by a fairly young person, but it tends to be still fairly rare. Not that the juveniles don't commit homicide, but I've not seen a great increase in my experience. For a while, I was head of juvenile prosecution in our office, and as violent crime as a whole went down through the first part of 2000-2001, we saw juvenile crime going down similarly. And so I think if crime is up, juvenile crime is probably a part of it, is also up, but I don't see any huge spike. There are instances where offenders will use juveniles because they think they can get away with it and put them through juvenile court where there'll be no consequence. But then I think a prosecutor should look at the use of the solicitation of a minor to commit a crime to charge that adult as well. And we should maybe be more aggressive in that.
Representative Kalin, and then we'll go to the PD.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cahill, in East Central Minnesota, all 5 of our counties, Chisago, Isani, Pine, Kennebec, and Mille Lacs, I believe all 5 of them are building new jails, largely because it's population growth, but a lot of it is methamphetamine and these nonviolent drug offenders and a high recidivism rate. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about in Hennepin County, what the impact of nonviolent drug offenses, what impact they have on your office, and also vis-a-vis recidivism as well. Also, if you've seen quickly any changes since the pseudoephedrine law was passed a couple years ago. Thanks.
So, Chair, Representative Kalin. Boy, that's a lot. Let me see if I can pick it apart a little bit. The rural areas have been devastated by methamphetamine, and we have seen it creeping into Hennepin County. It is now our number 2 drug offense is methamphetamine. Number 1 is still cocaine, and it's still primarily crack cocaine. We have not seen the ravages to the extent that rural Minnesota has seen within the metro area. What we see is about 2,000 cases a year that we charge of felony drug level cases. That has been handled for over 10 years by the Hennepin County Drug Court. Hennepin County Drug Court, as we speak, is being drastically changed. It used to be that if you had any drug offense, you went into drug court, you had judicial reviews, and you were treated as an addict. And what we've been saying for the last 10 years is not everybody is an addict. Not everybody should be treated the same. One size never does at all. And so after beating that drum for a long time, the court has been very cooperative lately under Chief Judge Whelan to change drug court to where the first part is standard criminal litigation. We charge somebody. We do a pretrial conference. If we can't settle it, we go to trial. And then and only then do we figure out, do they go in one of four different methods of supervision, one of which is the, what we call typically drug court, where a judge has a person appear in front of them weekly, monthly, sometimes twice a week, and have the judge intensively supervising that person's probation. That will be a much smaller population than it is now. First and second degree drug dealers, who are not addicts but actually dealing, are being sent to a calendar where we schedule all our violent crime cases, recognizing that they are more predators than they are addicts, and to be treated as such. And that started actually on January 1st. By the end of February, we should have the drug court changes in place, and not everybody is going to be treated like an addict. Only addicts are going to be treated like addicts.
I have just a real quick follow-up on that, and then we'll go to Mr. Hankus. Are the police being involved in the planning of the new drug court, unlike before?
Mr. Chair, I believe that Lieutenant Thomas was just put on the implementation and planning committee. Lieutenant Rick Thomas, who has a lot of experience in narcotics, was at the last meeting and had a lot of good input. We've always been talking to the police about what they would like to see in drug court and kind of have been speaking for them and their interests. And one of the main things being about the first and second degree drug dealers.
They didn't have an input the last time. We'll go to, now everybody hold their questions and Jim gets a chance.
Thank you. My name is Jim Hankus. I'm the Chief Public Defender here in Ramsey County. I've been doing this as a Chief Public Defender for 16 years. I started doing this in 1972, shortly after we graduated from law school, so it gives you an idea of how old we are. Ramsey County is the smallest county in the state. When I talk about what happens here, you'll probably not get the same language or information you get if you're talking about up in Pennington or any of the other outstate areas. Much different lifestyle, much different. Everything's dependent on where you live, and there's a lot of local norms for what's used and what isn't used. We have a jurisdiction that's Ramsey County, City of St. Paul, and I think it's 15 charging jurisdictions. And those 15 jurisdictions have a suburban court out in our Maplewood and on White Bear Avenue, just north of the fairgrounds, that is for all those people out of custody. Anybody not released from custody is kept in this. Kept in custody and handled downtown. City of St. Paul prosecutes every morning. I think up until about Mr. Lesh was here, and he would be able to tell. I think three in the morning is the cutoff. Anybody arrested before 3 in the morning gets on the morning calendar if it's charged with a misdemeanor. We have somebody there at 8 o'clock in the morning. The city attorney's been working before that, reviewing the files, confirming which ones should be thrown out, which ones should be prosecuted more heavily, and making recommendations as to what should happen. In our county, we have the City of St. Paul has an open file policy, which means that we go grab all the files in our desktop and head back to the cells to talk to people. Their files have all the police reports, and we get to review them right away, but when we're talking to the client, we have a realistic approach of what really happened there. We can, it's a pretty effective tool in terms of working cases out, making things move through the system in a positive manner. We also have a morning arraignment court in Maplewood. We have a morning arraignment court in the juvenile center. We have an afternoon arraignment court over in the courthouse, which is misdemeanors, people out of custody. It also includes our specialty courts, which are DWI court, mental health court, drug court, and homeless housing court, and I think any number of charges, any other. I think I've covered all of them we have. We also have every afternoon, 5 days a week, we have felony arraignments for the City of St. Paul and the suburban jurisdictions. That's prosecuted in our county by the county attorney's office. Everything else before that I talked about would have been prosecuted by the city attorney for that particular village or city or township, whatever it might be. Oftentimes those prosecutors tend to have two or three different jurisdictions that they handle. We handle probation violations. We handle CHIPS cases. We handle felonies. Last year was particularly an onerous year for us in this sense. We had 3 police homicides, which are a rarity in our community. I think 10 years since we had one previously. We had 3 police homicides plus a deputy sheriff was shot, who did not die. He's back on duty at the present time. Those homicides took 2 lawyers each for nearly a year preparing for them because there was so much subject matter. Typical homicide case is a 1 to 3 banker's boxes of storage materials. We just know what we put away. With these cases, we put away 8 boxes each, which means we had that much information just we had to go through and plug through. We have about 52 or 53 lawyers who work for us. We handled 21,428 cases last year. That's the calendar year. Our fiscal year was nearly the same amount of cases. Just we're off by half a year for that. We're seeing a slight upward trend again. We've been as high as 25,000 cases. In the modern times, we've been as low as 17,000 when the economy was extremely good. So right now, we're about median. Our jurisdiction will handle about 2,500 felonies for Ramsey County. I think the public defender over in Hennepin probably handles about 2.5 times what we do. Typically, Hennepin's been about 2.5 times anything we have. We're one of the 4 largest jurisdictions in the state in terms of population and caseload. Anoka County, with its large number of juveniles, has managed to pass us. We were always second in the state for fraternity, yes. We'd always been second in the state. But Anoka County, with a large number of juveniles, has passed us in the, when I say Anoka County, I mean the full 10th district, which runs all the way up through Pine, Kanabic, all those counties. And then the first district, which is just below us, Dakota County, and going west, is right behind us. Well, we have 21,000 cases, they have 20,500. Statewide, we represent at least 175,000 cases. I know that sometimes in our history, we represent over 200,000 cases. We do that with, I think, a statewide, Jonathan, correct, about 500 lawyers statewide. We got 87 different counties, county attorneys prosecute. We have a lot of different jurisdictions, a lot of different places we cover. We handle clients were given to us by the court. The court appoints all clients before we see them. In some jurisdictions, we pick them up at first appearance, which is what we do. That means for the first time they're in court, we interview them right away. In other jurisdictions, they have to request a public defender. They come in 2, 4, 6 weeks later, which takes a little bit more of a delay. Ours is immediacy. On felonies, we're there in the afternoon. 2 weeks later, we have an omnibus hearing. Some 5 to 6 weeks after that, we'll have a pretrial and a trial to follow that. Trials can be handled as short as 10 weeks, can take as long as a year to get to. Depends on the facts, what information we have, that sort of thing. On misdemeanors, we get more quickly to the trial dates, but the trial dates tend to roll over a little more because we have a problem there with not enough prosecutors, not enough defenders, not enough judges. It's a system-wide problem, particularly we feel as public defenders are the ones who are shorthanded, but that isn't what we're always told by others. We have a shallow administrative system in the sense that John Stewart, who's here, is my supervisor. I'm a supervisor in my office. We have 5 managing attorneys and the rest are lawyers. All of our lawyers handle cases. There isn't any long... The individual is who we were representing. We're not representing the system. We're representing each individual on each case. So in that sense, we don't give a lot of supervision to our people other than to try and make sure they're in the right place, make sure they've got the information they need, make sure they've got the supplies or the support they need. But we don't sit and tell them what to do because we have a kind of situation where I think 2 years ago maybe we had a homicide. There were 7 people charged. We had 6 of them. So we had to get conflict lawyers for all the lawyers except for one who went into the full-time office. That's not untypical. It seems that everybody who wants to shoot somebody tends to bring their friend along to borrow the gun from. They borrow somebody else's car and tell them they're going to drive the car to shoot somebody so they know about it. I mean, nobody just does it alone. I mean, so it ends up with just a real, you might only have, I think we only had 18 homicides in our county last year, but I can tell you there were a lot more defendants than that. I think we had around, I know Hennepin has a lot more, but some of your guys go work alone.
That many.
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of thing where it just ties up all the resources of an office. You're talking about homicide, like those police homicides where new people are going away for life without a chance of parole, and all of the attendant situation of that. It took all of our resources. We only have 3 paralegals for our 21,000 cases. They were tied up. We had our 4 investigators. They were tied up. I mean, I think there's 500 cops in St. Paul. Is that right? What's in the list? Around 550 in each of the 15 jurisdictions has a number of other ones. And we have 4 people to check on those reports or check on those witnesses. Now, the good news is we don't go to trial in all of our cases in terms of efficiency in the system. We come in on our first appearance. We talk to the county attorney's office between the first appearance and the second appearance. I think fully 50% of our, up to 50% of our felonies have been resolved by the OAS omnibus hearing, which comes out in 2 weeks. In terms of resolve, we say that we've worked out some kind of a jury of what will happen to it. I mean, it'll be sentenced later on. There'll be a PSI done, pre-sentence investigation, that sort of thing. We'll come back for sentencing. And oftentimes, in any case, it gets sent on probation. We often come back for probation violation because many of our clients, most of our clients, are chemically dependent or have at least been using chemicals sometime in the process. You asked about crack cocaine versus meth. Meth does exist in the Twin Cities. Meth exists in St. Paul. It does not exist like it does if you're in Wilmer or if you're in Barnum, Minnesota, or Pine City, or any of the other places that are out there. Crack cocaine is still a major problem in St. Paul, but meth also is. It's also one of those things that tends to show up a lot in our system. We don't have enough staff to follow up on our cases as well as we would. I'm sure that we'll tell you at different times during the hearings how we feel about it, how our caseloads are extraordinarily high. They are. You're trying to handle 8, 10, 12 people at a pretrial, and you're trying to give them each 10 minutes to talk to, and the judge has only got 2 hours to handle your case. It just doesn't work. You're trying to work to negotiate with a city attorney or negotiate with a county attorney, and they've also got us plus how many private lawyers. So we're staff light for some of the kinds of things like this. In an office like ours, we don't have secretaries. We have some clerk and people to open files. If you can't type, don't come to work in our office. I mean, we have our own, luckily with computers, you can put macro letters on computers and you can work things out. But we gave up secretaries, I think, 15, 20 years ago when we started needing, we all of a sudden turned them into lawyers or something else whenever those salaries disappeared because we got so much caseload. We're a responsive agency. We only respond to whatever's charged. We don't know what's coming in any given day, and we're not allowed to turn it down. So we might get a terrible Monday, or we might get a light Monday. We don't know what's there. We get as many as 54 misdemeanor cases in the morning, or we get as light as 15 or 10 or 5. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if the Taste of Minnesota is going to have a situation. We don't know if the State Fair is going to have a situation where they arrest a lot of people on drug charges. Those all come to us. We don't know if any of the holiday-type things, they tend to bring us a lot of different full moon, there's a lot of different things that cyclical that work and work less. It's a real thing. I mean, we get cases in all these situations. Our drug court is different than Hennepin County's. In a sense, our drug court was a much smaller conception. It started out with 25 people. We're going to see if we can keep people out of custody, if we can work with them. What we found is we had a tremendously good success rate. Those who go into the drug court don't come back out. And one of the things you find when you get somebody in the criminal system often is they tend to be tumbling. They tend to be somewhere in their life where there's chaos. They get 2-3 charges. They end up using. They end up giving up on their life or whatever else it might be. They just keep rolling through it. When you stop them chemically from abusing and start paying attention to them and just all of a sudden jerk them by the back of the neck and hold them in place for a moment, their life sort of stops. They quit getting that second and third charge. They start, throughout your drug court, you'll end up with a job. You'll end up paying child support. You'll end up having health insurance. Some of these things that are beyond just criminal justice costs, they're all of a sudden resolved by what drug court brings to the picture. You'll find that they're going 2 years with maybe one or two slips. And the slip doesn't equal going to jail. Slip means you end up doing some other kind of work you might have to do, or do a couple days in jail, or get taken, the day before Christmas, you get put in jail for 4 days because you slipped. It's the price you agreed to pay, and that's what you end up paying. Drug court has been tremendously successful. Both people have gone and seen it from the state have liked what it's brought to the place. I think we have over 100 and some clients in drug court right now. But those people are going 2 years or more without getting rearrested. Many of them, they're not all first-timers who didn't get involved. A lot of times, any number of them are referrals from probation. People who are failing on probation, they get sent over to drug court just so they can get some kind of a tighter maintenance on them. Something about the amount of attention that's paid to them and the amount of interest that's paid actually pays off in a very positive manner. But either drug court is equally as successful. Long, you can't get it unless you've got 40 DWIs prior. Those with 4 priors tend not to get recidivism. I don't know that we've ever... I was on that oversight committee for over 2 years. We didn't have anybody get rearrested for a DWI one time. I think we've had a couple failures since. We've gotten arrested for driving, other things, but not for a DWI. The city of St. Paul, during when we were really short of funding a couple of years ago, changed a little bit of how they prosecute how just the basic traffic charges, so we don't get so many of those. It seems that today our caseload tends to be more enhanced cases, more serious cases. We can't remember the last time somebody had a garage burglary or a gas station burglary, which seemed to be the norm. It seems like there's always now a gun involved or somebody's house. It's serious stuff. I mean, it tends to be a very serious nature. Domestic assault strangulations, I think you've probably read in the paper how many strangulations have been charged in Minnesota this year, like 1,001 or something. Those were cases we didn't have last year. We didn't have them as a felony. They were misdemeanor assaults, or they were domestic assaults, which were handled at a different level. I mean, all those things that come into our offices, we have to defend. I don't know what percentage we handle the state defense, but we handle a great amount of it. In the city of St. Paul, we handle, I think, a great deal more than we do in the suburbs. Suburbs have people with a little more money, a little more funding. I keep looking at him because Hennepin County has a big suburban area with all that tax base. Ramsey County is much tighter and much smaller.
I don't see any of it.
We don't have any administrative type crimes that take money in our district, so we don't have that situation. The funny part is I've been wrong long too long. In 1975, when we switched to new criminal rules, all of the cases which used to be handled as ordinance violations, if you didn't have a right to a jury trial, you had a right to a court trial. And then they decided in 1975 all of these cases would be handled by jury trials, and the city quit doing those ordinance things. And now it's all of a sudden it's coming back. It's a new change. It's back to, I guess, somebody's reinventing the wheel in a different way, I think that's what I'd have to say. Our caseload has many different facets to it. We have people who are chemically dependent. When people ask me who we represent, I often say we represent your children. And that includes my own. I mean, nobody's immune from having somebody they're related to in court, whether it be for domestic, whether it be for chemical dependency. I mean, I've represented the children of 3M executives who've been given up by the family. We represent the poorest person in town who has no family at all. We represent the whole gamut of society. People who don't have funding. As I say, the funding issue is one decided by the judges. They actually have a screening process that works, we hope, as often as it does. The citations, the cases like that, we get a lot of citations charged by police that are reviewed by a city attorney and dismissed for reasons having to do with they just shouldn't have been charged in the first place, or the situational thing, where those cases don't get to us. Those are taken care of before they come into our office. We instead get those who actually the city attorney has decided it's worth keeping. We have gangs in St. Paul, just like every place else. We don't have as severe a problem in as Hennepin. But remember, this is a statewide system. The people who are in the 4th District Public Defender Office have all those situations. If you were talking to my friend Tim Johnson, who's the public defender in Wilmer, Minnesota, he would tell you a whole other problem having to do with getting to jails and courthouses that are 35 miles away. Talk to Fred Friedman out of Duluth. He talked about the Virginia courthouse where he has to public defenders drive 82 miles just to get to a case. We, because we're in Ramsey County, have a much smaller distance in terms of we got to go a mile over to the new law enforcement center. I understand that one of the stops you're going to be making with Representative Paymar is down there next Monday. We'll actually be able to get people into the cell area, and we've talked to the sheriff's office, and we'll take them in and show them what it's like.